Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
There's a significant verse in Psalm 24, the beginning of that psalm, that maybe will inform our conversation today, or at least should on a regular basis. Psalm 24, verse 1 says, "The earth is the Lord's, and everything in it, the world and all who live in it." We're going to talk today a little bit about stewardship and maybe about the principle of ownership, you know, that God creates everything, and he puts us in the garden to take care of it. And that we have the work of stewardship of all the creation that God has given to us. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today with Dr. Cal Beisner, who's the founder and the national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. It's a network of over 60 Christian theologians, natural scientists, economists, and other scholars educating from biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the proclamation and the defense of the good news of salvation by God's grace received through faith in Jesus Christ. And we are excited to have a conversation with Cal Beisner again. We get a chance to talk with him once in a while. And Ted, I'm thinking we should mention another important verse.
Yes.
From Micah 6, 8.
Oh, yes.
You know,
what does the Lord require of you?
Yeah,
right?
This is what the Lord requires, to do what's right, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. And that's the theme for our writer's contest going on here for another few days.
That's right. You can submit your work of fiction or nonfiction right now at myfaithradio.com. It's right there on the main page banner. Just click on the link to the Faith Radio's writer contest, and there you can submit your work. Go there even and just peruse what's already been submitted. Yeah. It's pretty interesting. Some good writing already coming
right.
in.
Right, and you have the opportunity to vote for your favorite, so you get to be a part of that. So we encourage you to do that. Check it out, myfaithradio.com. Glad to have you along today on Connecting Faith. We talk a little bit about earth stewardship, and it's a topic that seems to be in much debate, maybe more so today than ever before. And, of course, today maybe we have more women listening because they've taken the day off work, right? Isn't that today?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, right.
Or maybe not. Well, let me introduce Dr. Cal Beisner, again, founder and national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance. He was associate professor of historical theology and social ethics at Knox Seminary previously, and before that, he also taught at Covenant College, and he has been around in a variety of circumstances and situations teaching around the globe, actually, and we are honored to have him with us today. He's written over 10 books and contributed to or edited many more, and so we always love the opportunity to talk creation care, climate, environment, all those things. Cal, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Thanks very much, Neil. Great to be back with you. And I hope that you up there in Minnesota and Wisconsin and all those northern states are going to be enjoying a little bit warmer weather before too long.
That is the hope that would help all our colds, of which we are suffering with, is waiting to kind of bake it out in the Florida sun where you get to experience more of that. Anyway.
Right. I'm figuring to take a nice long bike ride right after this.
Okay. All right.
That's 88-degree weather.
That somehow sounds wrong. But, weather is sort of one of the things that we'll end up talking about, because climate and weather seems to be frequently in the news, and, there's a lot of strong opinions about it, but maybe we'll get into that. But I know that you recently wrote some things about the new director of the EPA, Scott Pruitt. Just would like to get your assessment of his background and interests and what he will bring to the table.
Well, Scott Pruitt is formerly the Attorney General of the state of Oklahoma, and he was recently confirmed by the Senate to be the new administrator of the EPA, the federal EPA. And even the very simple fact that I just made that distinction, the federal EPA, is relevant because Pruitt is somebody who is committed to the principle of federalism that's written into the United States Constitution. That is, we're not just one big nation with one big government. We have a national government, we have state governments, we have county governments, we have city governments. And Pruitt believes, as did America's founders, and that's the way they—that's the reason they wrote the Constitution the way they did, that laws and policies and regulations and the like should be made on as local a level as possible, because frankly, one size doesn't fit all. Regulations about, air pollutant emissions that make sense for Manhattan, with about 65,000 people per square mile, don't necessarily make real great sense for North Dakota, with maybe about 8 or 10 people per square mile, yeah. Something like that. And so that's one of the first things that I really appreciated about Scott Pruitt, is that he's a constitutionalist. He believes in federalism. He also believes in the separation of powers, that Congress is supposed to make laws, and the executive branch is supposed to implement and enforce those laws. And that means that executive branch agencies, like the EPA, are supposed to write regulations that stay within the boundaries of the legislation that Congress has passed. And unfortunately, for not just the last 8 years, but, easily the last 25 years or so, the federal EPA has been, in many instances, writing regulations that go well beyond the boundaries of the statutes that Congress passed, on which they presume that their regulations are based. Particularly, this has happened with regard to the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and Pruitt again is saying, look, we have a constitution. It tells us that we have different branches of government. We want to make sure that the EPA stays within its proper bounds, which is why, by the way, as Attorney General in Oklahoma, he actually sued the EPA a number of different times on the grounds that he thought that it exceeded the boundaries of the legislation that it claimed was justification for its new regulations. He won a few, he lost a few, and some are actually still pending. Of course, he'll no longer be involved in prosecuting those suits since he's now administrator of the EPA. But that's the way that goes. So those are the first two reasons that I like him, and there are more.
Hmm. Well, I'm interested, as you said, the EPA has made regulations and put standards in place over the past, 20-plus years. One would say, well, has it really hurt us? I mean, don't we have the best, water and air standards quality that we've ever had? So anything wrong with that?
Well, and that actually points to another of the reasons that I like Scott Pruitt so much as the new administrator. He is committed to the principle of cost-benefit analysis. That is, every proposed new regulation needs to be very carefully evaluated in terms of how much good will be achieved by implementing that versus how much harm might be done at the same time by implementing that. He wants to be sure that we only implement regulations where the good achieved outweighs the harm that's also done. And frankly, that invariably happens. Life is filled with what economists call opportunity costs. If I do this, I can't do that, right? And so if, for example, with the mercury and air toxins regulation that EPA adopted several years ago, EPA did a cost-benefit analysis on that frankly was very, very badly flawed and deceptive. It claimed that thousands of lives would be saved each year by reducing mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants into the air. The reality is that all of those lives that got saved were saved by what EPA itself called co-benefits, that is, reductions in other pollutants that would happen at the same time as trying to reduce mercury emissions. Well, the appropriate thing to do about that would have been to regulate those other pollutants, not the mercury, because as EPA's own data showed, the mercury constituted no risk to actual real people. It constituted a hypothetical risk to hypothetical people, namely the infants in the womb of mothers who ate at least 200 pounds of self-caught fish from the country's worst polluted mercury-receiving waters each year. And EPA acknowledged there are no such women. So in other words, theoretically, if there were, those babies would be at risk. But in fact, there weren't any such women, and so those babies are not at risk. So, you know, Pruitt wants to say, let's stop this sort of game playing and do proper cost-benefit analysis, and I think that's a very good thing. Besides that, Pruitt also believes firmly in the necessity of sound scientific basis for all regulation and of sound economic analysis for all regulation, and I think those are very good things.
Is cost-benefit analysis, let me put it this way, is stewardship based on cost-benefit analysis? Because I think sometimes we hear that and say, well, it's not everything's all about economics, and shouldn't we care for creation? And so how does stewardship fit in with cost and benefit?
Well, you know, it's really simply unavoidable. All of us do it all the time. We do it without even thinking about it. And right now, you and I are doing this radio program, right?
Yeah.
We're doing this now instead of my going down to the beach to swim or you're going out to ski, right?
Yeah.
We're doing this now because we've decided that we think that the benefits of doing this, not just to us, but to other people as well, are greater than the benefits of doing something else. That's, you know, every one of us makes decisions like that all the time without even thinking, oh, I'm doing cost-benefit analysis. What we spend, the time we spend doing one thing, we can't spend doing a different thing at the same time. Well, women can. They can multitask a whole lot better than we men can. But, you know, okay, so the time they spend doing those 10 things, they can't spend doing 20 other things instead, right? The money that we spend on this, we cannot spend on that. And so, really, cost-benefit is unavoidable. And not only is it unavoidable, but it's really of the essence of stewardship. I am given by God management, stewardship of time, energy, money, friendships, knowledge, opportunities to learn, and so on. And I need to use those opportunities in ways that best promote the glory of God, the growth of Christ's kingdom, and the benefit of my neighbors, to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with God. I really need to do stewardship, cost-benefit analysis to figure out what all three of those things mean.
Talking today with Dr. Cal Beisner, we're talking about stewardship. Cal's the founder and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. We'll get into more about, you know, some principles of stewardship, responsibility, and accountability. We'll also talk about the carbon footprints and more in the moments ahead. Dr. Beisner was an associate professor of historical theology and social ethics at Knox Theological Seminary for a number of years and focused on application of biblical worldview, theology, and ethics to economics, government, and public policy. And he is leading now the Cornwall Alliance. It has a large group of Christian theologians and scientists and economists and others that are educating for biblical earth stewardship. We'll find out more what that's like. You can join the conversation, by the way, 877-933-2484. Our phone number, 877-93-FAITH. Or if you'd rather submit a question or comment via email, you can do that. Go to myfaithradio.com, click on the Connecting Faith show page, and there's an email link there. You can submit your question. We'll talk more with Cal Beisner just ahead. Program talking about that important verse, Psalm 24, verse 1. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. And that is our calling, that there's an issue of ownership and God owns it all. But we want to be good stewards. That's what God has placed us here for, to be a steward the creation that God has given us. And we're talking today with Dr. Cal Beisner, founder and the national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. And Cal, you've found yourself in the organization over the years trying to present some biblical clarity in the whole area of environmental concerns and, you know, climate change and the like. Give us a sense of what you see as the maybe the environmental movement as it's configured today, what their priorities or highest priorities are.
You know, that will vary as you go to different parts of the movement. Some parts focus heavily on climate change, others on say rainforest preservation, others on species extinction. some on oceans, and so on. I mean, different parts of the movement have different emphases. I think the unifying themes for the movement, some of them are very good unifying themes, such as we do want to make sure that we don't just destroy major parts of the Earth, that we don't, frankly, destroy any parts of the Earth. We want to, as I put it in the Cornwall Alliance, we want to enhance the fruitfulness and the beauty and the safety of the Earth to the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors. Unfortunately, a fair amount of the environmental movement, especially the parts that are the most clearly anti-Christian, there are many parts that are either atheistic or pantheistic, seems to see human beings as basically consumers and polluters. We're using up all the Earth's resources, and we're polluting, poisoning the planet while we're at it. And therefore, they tend to be fairly anti-human. If it's choice between polar bears and human beings, well, they would prefer the polar bears. And so we have the population control movement, the whole notion that the world is overpopulated and so on. And this really runs contrary to the biblical teaching that human beings are created in God's image to be creative and productive as he is. I like to put it sometimes this way. For every mouth born into the world, there are typically two hands, and much more important, a mind. And those two hands, guided by that mind, can create far more than that mouth consumes in a lifetime. So we can actually improve the Earth from the condition in which we find it through our lifetimes. And that's what we want to encourage people to do at the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation.
Your latest email, or one of your most recent emails, discussed educating American school children about evaluating economic and environmental policy. I'd be interested in how you're assessing, what our children are learning and what they're believing as a result of education today.
Yeah. Unfortunately, most of what's getting taught in the public schools in this general field, it comes from the secular atheistic, or increasingly also the pantheistic worldview and ethical perspective, rather than the Christian perspective. And so, for example, nowadays the whole treatment of the climate change question is almost exclusively presented in terms of thinking that human emission of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere when we burn fossil fuels to provide electricity and transportation fuels and the like, that these CO2 emissions are causing dangerous global warming, so dangerous indeed that we need to take drastic steps to reduce our use of those fossil fuels, to reduce that global warming. And we need to do that even if it's going to cost an enormous amount of money. To exemplify that, to illustrate that, the climate treaty worked out in Paris at the end of 2015 and ratified by many countries starting in May of 2016, if that is fully implemented, all the nations do what they say they intend to do under that, the actual change in global average temperature at the end of this century would be about 0.306 degree Fahrenheit. That is 0.3 of a degree Fahrenheit. That's not even measurable on a global basis, and it has zero impact on humanity or any other living thing on the Earth. But the cost of doing that would be roughly $1 trillion to $2 trillion per year. And that's all assuming the very ideas of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the organization that is pushing for this kind of thing. Now, as I look at that, I say to myself, even if they're right about how much warming comes from CO2, and I think they're wrong, I think they exaggerate very considerably, but even if they're right about that, the fact that it would cost that much to make that little difference in temperature at the end of this century suggests to me that there are far better uses for that $1 to $2 trillion a year that it would cost the global economy, like providing pure drinking water, sewage sanitation, nutrition supplements, basic health care, control of infectious diseases, things of that sort in developing countries that at this point lack those things. the result in terms of improved human health and lifespan would be far, far greater by spending the money that way than by spending it to reduce global average temperature by 0.3 of a degree at the end of the century.
If we if the temperature raised a degree or two, would that, I mean, that would actually help promote probably growth, would not? Wouldn't it? I mean,
yeah, and this is another of the things that unfortunately gets ignored in much of the communication about climate change. Even according to the UN IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, even according to them, warming driven by increasing CO2 in the atmosphere happens mostly toward the poles, not toward the equator, that is, in the coldest regions of the Earth, not the warmest regions. It happens mostly in the winter, not in the summer, that is, in the coldest times of the year, and mostly at night, not in the daytime, that is, in the coldest time of day. So, in other words, you're not going to see an increase in extreme heat all over the world. Instead, you're going to see a decrease in extreme cold. Well, extreme cold kills about 10 times as many people per day as extreme heat does. Further, as you reduce that extreme cold toward the poles in the winter at night, you lengthen growing seasons, and you wind up with more agricultural production, which means more food, which means less costly food, which means you feed the poor around the world more easily than you otherwise would. And that's without even looking at the other benefit of more CO2 in the atmosphere. CO2 is essentially plant food. It's, you know, plants have to have it for photosynthesis, and the more of it they get, the better they grow. For every doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere, there's an average 35% increase in plant growth efficiency, and that also means more food for everything that eats plants or eats something that eats plants, and the poor, again, benefit more than anybody else. So we at the Cornwall Alliance have been trying to help people to understand these things so that they can inform their government leaders and the like, no, we really don't want to try to implement the Paris Climate Agreement. We want instead to see people rise out of poverty, because poverty has far greater risks than anything related to climate.
Cal, we've got a break coming up in just a minute, but give us the web address for the Cornwall Alliance. People want to find out more. How do they find out?
Get connected. Right. That's cornwallalliance.org. Cornwall Alliance, all one word, .org. And we have a free newsletter that they can sign up for. We have books and DVDs available, and for free, hundreds of articles and some major studies, videos and the like, all at cornwallalliance.org.
All right. Dr. Cal Beisner, founder and national spokesman of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. He's an author and a professor, speaker, and he's with us today on Connecting Faith, and we're going to get to a question or two that you might have at 877-933-2484, 877-93-FAITH. And coming back, we'll talk about what does the biblical worldview of care creation look like. I get Cal's response just ahead. Stay tuned. Talking creation care today with Dr. Cal Beisner, founder and national spokesman for the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. Dr. Beisner has been a professor, and he's studied religion and philosophy, economic ethics, history of political thought, and much more. And we're always glad to have an opportunity just to connect with him. The Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation is a network of over 60 Christian theologians, natural scientists, economists, and other scholars educating or biblical earth stewardship. And, Cal, let's get to a call. We've got Mark, who's been waiting, calling in from Goodrich, North Dakota, with a comment on CO2. Mark, go ahead. You're on with Cal Beisner.
Thank you for taking my call. I agree with what your guest said about the cost-benefit analysis of capping CO2 emissions. In fact, former EPA director under President Obama admitted in a Senate hearing that, in fact, there were zero benefits that could be proven by capping CO2 emissions. And as I told the call screener, God did create us to emit CO2 when we exhale, and every plant needs CO2 to breathe. And And unfortunately, the Supreme Court has ruled that CO2 is a pollutant, and we need to push back on that because, in fact, that is not true. CO2 is a trace gas. It's my understanding that it only comprises 33 one-thousandths of the Earth's atmosphere, and of that 33 one-thousandths, only 3% is man-made. And you spoke about the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And, of course, they get much of their data from the CRU, the Climate Research Unit in the UK, the Hadley Climate Center. And their emails were hacked. And the director admitted in one of his emails that they were manipulating the temperature to show a rise in temperature, that they were, in fact, fraudulently showing a rise in global temperature. So this goes back to what I would believe to be the money changers that Jesus Christ railed against in the temple, because it's really a Wall Street bank, Goldman Sachs, that's pushing this cap and trade, which would allow them to make contracts and give contracts and create huge profits for them by creating this market that would result from capping CO2 emissions. So I really think it's godless money changers who are really pushing this CO2 emissions, capping emissions agenda, which gives them tremendous control.
Well, Mark,
the human population.
Let me give Cal a chance to respond to your well-informed thoughts.
Yeah, and Mark, you said quite a lot of different things there. And certainly what you said about carbon dioxide is absolutely true. It is, I like to call it the elixir of life. It is absolutely essential to life on Earth. Plants use it for photosynthesis. They take CO2 in, and then they emit oxygen. Animals, including human beings, take oxygen in and then emit CO2. And as a matter of fact, when we breathe out, our breath has about 40,000 parts per million carbon dioxide. And that compares with, at the moment, something in the neighborhood of 400 parts per million carbon dioxide in the air around us in the world. So our breath is some 20 times, no, pardon me, 200 times as heavy in CO2 as is the air around us. And yet it doesn't kill us. CO2 is an odorless, colorless gas that is non-toxic at levels above 8,000 parts per million, unless those levels are sustained for many months on end for human beings. There's no way it should have been called a pollutant. And yeah, there are moneyed interests behind the whole global warming scare. One person who I think made that point very clearly was actually a proponent of the scare. Otmar Edenhofer is a German economist who was a co-chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Back in 2010, he said, "We must not think of the annual climate summits organized by the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. We must not think of these summits as environmental summits. They have, as he put it, almost nothing to do with the environment anymore. It's all about redistributing the world's wealth from industrialized countries to developing countries, and a great deal of that is done by government agencies and by central bank agencies. And so, yes, indeed, major bankers and the like have a lot of at stake in this. But the big thing that we have to do is keep coming back to the basic science, and the science tells us that the computer models that are the only basis for predictions of dangerous man-made global warming have been invalidated. On average, they predict 2 to 3 times as much warming as actually observed over the relevant period. None of them predicted the complete absence of warming from early 1997 to late 2015, an absence that will resume when we come out of the heavy, the strong El Nino that made 2016 extra warm. And 95% of them predict more warming than actually observed. That means that they are wrong. The models cannot be trusted for predictions of future temperature, and therefore also cannot provide rational grounds for any policies regarding climate change. So that's sort of a basic message that we have on this topic from the Cornwall Alliance, and it's supported in a number of major papers at our website, cornwallalliance.com. faithfulgrass.org, and in our documentary video, Where the Grass is Greener, Biblical Earth Stewardship versus Climate Alarmism, available through wherethegrassisgreenerthemovie.com. That's wherethegrassisgreenerthemovie.com.
All right. Let people know about that, as well as cornwallalliance.org or wherethegrassisgreenerthemovie.com. We have a few minutes left and a lot more we could talk about, but Dr. Beisner, give us a sense of some maybe the fundamental principles of a biblical worldview on care of creation. We talked earlier about, you know, what students are learning today. They're the framework that, you know, much of media delivers to us. So how do we contrast that with a biblical worldview? What are some of the primary points?
Well, we would start with the creator-creature distinction, the fact that God has made an orderly universe to be understood by rational creatures made in his image. So the creator-creature distinction, the fact that man is made in the image of God and that he's given dominion over the earth, we are not supposed to be under the earth, but the earth is supposed to be under us. We would move to the fact that God loves life and variety and fertility and the like. We see that in Genesis 1. And so our exercise of this dominion should reflect that. That's why we describe it as enhancing the fruitfulness, the beauty, and the safety of the earth to the glory of God and the benefit of our neighbors. We recognize the importance of private property because what people own, they have a strong incentive to take good care of. That's why you find graffiti on public restroom walls and not on the walls of your bathroom at home, frankly. So those are some of the basic ideas. Many more are discussed in Cornwall Alliance's various different papers, and particularly in a lecture, a DVD video lecture that I've done called Godly Dominion versus Environmentalism. That, too, is available from cornwallalliance.org. If people go there and just click on the shop tab, they'll be able to find that DVD.
Thanks so much for that good little summary. I know you've got a day of prayer coming up March 25 here in just a couple weeks. So what are you praying about? And tell me more about it.
Yeah, this is our annual day of prayer, and we chose March 25 because it is the birthday of Norman Borlaug, who was a Nobel Peace Prize winner and winner of all sorts of other great awards. He's often referred to as the man who fed the world or the man who saved 2 billion people. It's estimated that his advances in hybridization of corn and wheat and rice and other grain crops brought 2 billion people in the world out of starvation into abundant and adequate food supplies. So on this day of prayer, March 25, we encourage people to pray for the poor around the world and to pray for good environmental stewardship. And we lead up to that by posting various different prayers on our website and on our Facebook page, Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation at Facebook, and on our blog, earthrisingblog.com, which is especially designed for millennials. So we post prayers by pastors, by theologians, by scientists and economists and mission workers and the like along those lines of poverty relief, economic development, and environmental stewardship, all harking back to Norman Borlaug, who we think was just an outstanding example of that kind of stewardship.
And, of course, we can claim him here being Minnesotan, so that makes
yes,
it even
indeed.
Better. Yeah. All right, Callan, good to talk with you once again. Our time is slipping by, but we want to just encourage people to check out the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation. Go to cornwallalliance.org, and you'll find a number of resources there. It's a network of over 60 Christian theologians, natural scientists, economists, and other scholars educating for biblical earth stewardship, economic development for the poor, and the proclamation and the defense of the good news of the gospel. So welcome that to you to check it out, or you can find the movie as well, Where the Grass is Greener, themovie.com. Cal, blessings to you. Thanks for the work you're doing. I always enjoy talking with you.
Thanks, Neil, and blessings to you too and all of your work.
You're listening to Connecting Faith, and coming up in just a few minutes, we'll connect with Leith Anderson, making his regular every other Wednesday visit, so I want to encourage you to stay tuned for that. By the way, if you missed part of today's conversation with Dr. Beisner, want to hear it again or pass it on to a friend, let me just encourage you to go to myfaithradio.com and then click on the Connecting Faith show page to hear the interview posted there and many other great interviews as well. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for joining us today. And because it's a Wednesday, it means it's an opportunity for us to connect with Leith Anderson. Leith is a Christian leader, author, professor, pastor, longtime pastor at the Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, and now serves as the president of the National Association of Evangelicals. And we always appreciate the opportunity to talk about the church and culture and issues of faith. And Leith, I wanted to just start out our conversation today. Last week, I was at the National Religious Broadcasters Convention, and I was just kind of amazed again at the multitude of sessions. There was one on the unfinished task, you know, showing the millions around the globe who haven't even heard the name of Jesus. And then there's sessions on reviewing increased restrictions on religious freedom, talking about how to be salt and light in Hollywood, promoting pro-life causes, etc. And I thought, you know, it's so hard to focus on what is of maybe primary importance or most urgent, and maybe those don't always go together. It'd be interested in your thoughts. How do we actually align our lives and priorities according to biblical priorities? What does that look like?
Those are big and important issues, and they're actually big and important to me and to the National Association of Evangelicals. But I'll give you my personal opinion. And for me, the number one priority is evangelism, that Jesus' Great Commission is to make disciples, and that extends for all of eternity. Not other things that are important, but to me that is top importance, top priority. And you know, when you say, you know, how do you prioritize? How do you rate it? And I know this is an explanation that sort of has some defects in it, but I think of myself as sitting down with Christians in other centuries or in other parts of the world and saying, what do you think is most important as a committed follower of Jesus Christ? And I think where we would agree is on evangelism. You know, Jesus was in a tumultuous political time. My goodness, the first century in Judea and Galilee, tough issues, Roman taxes and racial and ethnic tensions and sexual ethics. But he always kept his eyes on the cross and on our salvation. And to me, that's top of the list.
Leith, I'm just curious, for you personally, what does that look like? How do you evangelize and share the truth with others, maybe even strangers in like a public setting, a store or something like that?
I want to begin where they begin. I don't want to start saying, let me tell you what I have to say. I want to hear them out, and I want to talk about what they want to talk about. But as I was praying this morning, we live in a really troubled world, and one of the New Testament words is frequently used is being saved or salvation. And Jesus Christ is the only answer to the problems and the mess that we have in the world. So I'd like to bring it around to that conversation, and I seek to do it, but I seek to do it in a way that communicates where they're starting out, but not where I want them to end up.
You know, in light of that, you know, living in these kind of troubled times, obviously lots of last week, conflict continues, I guess, in terms of the president, and there were some protests or some marches and some counter marches. And so I'm reading Ephesians recently and noted Paul talking in Ephesians 3:17 about being rooted and grounded in love. And, you know, Paul didn't say being rooted and grounded in courage or conviction or in truth. And, you know, he goes on the next couple of chapters and gives this list of ways that we can walk worthy and have humility and live in purity and all those things. But I'm wondering, do we understand as believers what it means to be rooted and grounded in love? And how should that inform the rest of what we do and say?
those are words that we use in everyday language. You know, if you have a garden, you know what it means to be rooted. And if you have any electrical circuit, you know what it means to be grounded. So what is basic? What's primary? What's bedrock? And it's love, that God loves us, that we are to love him, we're to love others. So I want to always start there. Even people I don't like, don't agree with, I want to start there. And it doesn't mean we condone sin. You know, I thought, if I'm serving on a jury, I have a biblical responsibility to love the defendant, but I can still vote guilty. I can still send that person to prison, but I've got to always begin where the Bible begins, that God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son. You know, it's kind of interesting. I sent out a tweet just recently and quoted a verse from the Bible that says that we're to love immigrants, and suggested in that tweet that that's where we start. And then from that biblical command to love immigrants, then we decide our policy and our politics. My goodness, I had some critics who used, I won't even tell you what they said. They used words I don't want to tell you. Out of a call to do what the Bible says and love other people. So, yeah, that's where we've always got to start.
Oftentimes we need to get refreshed in the Word before we can continue sharing the truth and the hope with others, too. And I'm just curious for yourself, Leith, and maybe some encouragement for others that are looking to remain rooted and grounded in love and to flourish in that, and rooted and grounded in Christ, rather. What do you do, or do you have maybe a particular aspect of the Bible that you like to go to that's more invigorating for you, or maybe something you've taught on recently?
So, like, what's my favorite part of the Bible?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. What's your favorite part of the Bible?
Yeah, we're prioritizing today, so we want to know, what's number one?
Okay, well, you know, my fear is you're next going to ask me which one is of my four children are my favorite.
Yeah, right. Sure.
And then my greatest fear is, who am I going to like better? Is it going to be Neil or Ted?
Yes, well, that's, yes. It's the pressure's ratcheting up.
Here. I know the answer to that. That's
okay, so, you know, as a pastor, I've always loved reading and teaching the Gospels. It's the story of Jesus, and I like it better than any other part of the Bible because it's about Jesus Christ, and I'm a Jesus follower. I'm a Christian, and I always found and still do find that when you read the stories of Jesus, not only were they amazing for then and truly amazing, but they all connect to where we are and what we're doing today. They are so relevant, so... Yes, and where do people start? You know, if somebody doesn't know the Bible at all, I usually tell them to read Mark first. And I think that's pretty commonly done around the world. I think in America, in the church, we often say read John first, but Mark's a little bit easier to read than the other three Gospels. So I think that's a good place to begin.
You know, speaking of pastoring, you pastored for, 35 years just at Wooddale Church. Did you end up going through, I assume that you repeated a series or two over the course of those 35 years? Any recommendations to pastors, maybe preaching through maybe a gospel book again if they've done it already a couple of times, or a passage? What did you do when you were repeating something?
Neil, I don't know that I'm offended by the assumption that I repeated things. There seems to be an implication here that I repeated sermons, and I didn't. I actually, 35 years, I did not repeat the sermon.
Oh.
Too many people that have good memories and take detailed notes.
It's true.
Kind of hard to get away with that. You know, of course, if I did, for example, a series of sermons, which I did, on Mark or on John, which might have taken a year or two or three to get through them all, and then the next Easter, I'd still be able to go back to that part of the gospel story or go to the Christmas story in Matthew or Luke, even though I'd preached through that. But the Bible's an amazing book. It's got a lot to work with, and 35 years is nowhere near enough time to cover it all.
Good word. Yeah. All right. Leith, I know that the latest survey, the Evangelical Leader Survey that NAE puts out on a monthly basis, this time talked about religious freedom is for non-Christians, too. I know you mentioned that, the issue of immigration is still a major concern. Religious freedom is a primary concern as well. Just highlight a little bit of what that means, the survey results.
It is a big concern. And back to evangelism, I think it's a big concern for evangelism because where there is religious freedom, we have the freedom then to present the gospel. And I think the gospel is persuasive against any other argument or religion. Yeah, the question that was asked in the monthly survey was, do you support the same religious freedom protection for people of non-Christian faiths as for Christians? And this is a lot of evangelical leaders, and we got a 100% yes response. That is a rare thing. Everybody agreed. And it's, of course, supporting the First Amendment, but it was really interesting that missions leaders pointed out that when we send missionaries to countries that don't have religious freedom, we ask them to give Christians religious freedom, and that we need to do, you know, the same thing in our country. The right of Jews to have a synagogue or Muslims to have a mosque, I mean, those are clear examples. And I know there are limits to this, and there are challenges. Jehovah's Witnesses refuse to take blood transfusion as a religious conviction, or what comes in prisons and workplaces and schools. It's challenging, but we want the government to always tilt to the side of religious freedom, even though obviously sometimes there must be limitations.
Grateful for the leadership of the National Association of Evangelicals, and I know Leith, you just mentioned immigration. The president is reworking that immigration stay. And this clearly has become kind of a hot button issue, apparently for many of those that are responding to your tweet. Nothing else. Just maybe just summarize again where the gospel falls in this whole area of understanding and caring for those that are refugees and immigrants.
It's a complicated issue, and we estimate about 65 million refugees in the world today, the most since World War II. And I think we need to do our part, but it's only our part. We can't obviously help everybody, but we need to join with the rest of the world. As Christians, we're into saving people. That's what we do, but it's got to be in a measured and a careful way. So I'm all for having careful laws and regulations, but it needs to start out with love for the refugee and love for the immigrant and doing everything we can for people who are facing often enormous persecution and threats in the places from which they come.
Leith Anderson joining us today. He's president of the National Association of Evangelicals, a longtime pastor and a Christian leader and author. You can find out more about the great work of the National Association of Evangelicals on the website nae.net. Leith, always good to visit with you. Look forward to our next conversation.
And thanks and blessings.
Have you ever tried to share Christ with a family member who refuses to listen? Hi, I'm Steve Douglas for Making Your Life Count. And our guest today, Chris Randazzo, knows just how that feels. And he's here to tell us how God used some jail time in his father's life in a very positive way.
He had the opportunity to be presented with the gospel, and at one of those meetings, he ended up making a decision to give his life to Christ in jail at the age of 75.
As his father began reading the Bible, his entire attitude slowly began to change.
I actually was able to interact with my father about things of the faith for the first time in my life. My kids were able to talk to him about Bible stories for the first time. There was such a clear evidence of change in his life.
When you share your faith with loved ones, don't forget, you must leave the results to God. He is the one that is able to work in their lives, sometimes in very surprising ways.
That's quite a story. 75 years old, coming to faith. How encouraging. Don't give up. Thanks for praying. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being part of Faith Radio and supporting this ministry. If you're new to Faith Radio, I want to say welcome to you. We've got a welcome packet we can send you if you visit myfaithradio.com and just ask for that today. You'll find out a little bit more about this growing ministry. And I want to say welcome to those listening in Hartford at 94.1 FM or on the new translator in Waterloo at 93.1 FM, or in Madison at 104.7 FM, or in the Twin Cities at 90.7 FM, or streaming online. Glad to have you listening, wherever you might be. If you missed part of today's show, again, you can check it out at the Connecting Faith show page at myfaithradio.com. Tomorrow, it's God Among Sages. Kenneth Richard Samples, an apologist, will help us understand the reality of who Jesus is. It'll be a great time tomorrow. Hope you can join us then.
Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support, and you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.